We have been stealing the future from our children.
Challenges of conservation and combating climate change are connected.
Corruption is being created by wildlife crime.
Speciesism is very much the same as racism or sexism.
We must rethink our relationship with wildlife, the environment, and each other. Join us as we uncover the innovative, unifying, and urgent solutions we need to protect the planet from ourselves. This is the art of conservation.
Welcome back, guys. I'm still stuck in the bush, but I think you guys have had a slightly more comfortable 2 weeks than I have patrolling each night, full moon. So,
yeah, but you love it. Measures.
Well, she does.
You love it. You're all geared up. You're with Munu. You love the bush.
No, I do. And it really is very special. And I think I'm also one of those characters that I'm really bad at sitting on the sidelines. You know, we entrust so much into the people that are looking after Munu and the land and all of our team members here. But it's not a question of not trusting them. I just want to be in the mix. You know, I want to be here.
You have FOMO.
I have FOMO.
Yeah.
I absolutely do. But I mean, it's been full moon and it has, you know, for about a week, I don't think there was a cloud in the sky. Incredibly bright. And you know, the poaching incident that happened just before we went on air in our last episode, sort of a slight development from that. The guy's still at large. He's managed to evade capture so far, but it's one step closer. It's one step closer. There were some really good signs of collaboration between provincial law enforcement, between different private entities, security companies, and so on. So that bodes really well. I get encouraged when I see people working together, and then I get excited when I see people working together efficiently. And that's definitely what happened. So very, very cool work being done up here. But it's very different when you're walking around the bush at night in a bulletproof vest and you're not talking about anti-poaching and you're not talking about what it feels like to be at risk. It's very, very different when you're walking around in the bush at whatever time at night and you hear something and you can't identify whether that was a kudu or a leopard or a bushbuck or what was it. It changes it pretty quickly, I've got to be honest. So learning huge amounts as we grow our security capacities here and really feel quite fortunate to be surrounded by the caliber of people we've got working with us who can teach me and advise us on how we can accelerate the security. At the moment, I think the poachers have got the upper hand and we've got to play a bit of catch up. And I think we can do that by working together. So it's exciting, but I'm tired and I'm ready to come home to my wife and to my dog and to my father and to my family.
Your family's ready for you to come home.
You'll be looking forward to seeing you back, son.
So a long drive home and I will be there shortly. But what didn't get home was the auction. Last episode, we spoke at length. Well, we pretty much dedicated the episode to the potential auction of John Hume's Platinum Rhino operation in South Africa's Northwest Province. And wow, did that kick up some dust. I think that it was fairly equally weighted between a lot of people who reached out and said, finally, we're having the conversation about an investable conservation opportunity. And that's the discussion we should be having, whether you pro-trade or no trade. The need for having a discussion around increasing the viability of any for-profit conservation-based corporation should be the topic on all of our lips. And finally, this seemed to have like broken it out a little bit. And then there were those that came back and said, Borchard, you're talking absolute rubbish. You're smoking your socks. What do you know? This is all about trade and trade is the only answer, et cetera. But I am very encouraged that there've been some good discussions via email with Platinum Rhino. I wanted to reach out to them, as you guys know, to say, look, we can speculate and we can have a lot of discussions about what is, what might be, what could be, but it would be better to hear directly from you. You know, we are committed to giving fair and open platform to people that are making the news, and that's what we wanted to do. And before I could do that, a representative reached out to me and said, look, we want to chat to you. So I said, well, I'd love to have whoever on the podcast and let's talk about it. So that's been the intention. And as I'll get into now, obviously they've been completely snowed under with the amount of work and the amount of effort that they're putting into their ambitions. So we haven't been able to pin that down on when that discussion is going to happen. We'll probably chat offline first and figure out a good way to have that discussion. But I am encouraged that there was an acknowledgement from Platinum Rhino that said a collaborative discussion is important. And having this discussion over what role can and must Platinum Rhino play in conservation was acknowledged by those deep in the thick of it. So I'm encouraged by that. I'm obviously not going to go into the intricacies of the communication as yet. I want to try and reserve it and protect the sanctity of that once we're on air and be able to have a solid conversation about it. But what we do know was that there was no successful bid for the property for Platinum Rhino during the period described with the online auction. That failed. What we are aware of is that there are sideline negotiations happening that came through as a result of the auction. And so I think that they're starting to go into what we anticipated might be the case, whether there is a philanthropic play towards a conservation angle or whether they are unbundling the farms and the rhinos from a single lot into various lots and trading off the assets. We don't know the inner workings of those negotiations at the moment, but we know that they are taking place. So I am hoping that we are, as we find out, to talk to Platinum Rhino. And if they are one of their bidders who wants to come on board as well and have that discussion with us, that would be just as good and better, in fact. So we'll see where all of that lands. But I am very grateful that there wasn't, from Platinum Rhino, this aggressive defense, that there was, okay, there's information out there. Some of it we agree with, some of it we don't, but we would like the opportunity to clarify. And I took them on that opportunity to clarify, and we can debate it as those discussions mature and happen. So that was really cool. And then, my gosh, inbox and phone and social media lit up like a bloody Christmas tree. With ranging comments from great episode, thanks for the insight. And that was from all quarters. I had messages from Australia. I had messages from the USA. I had messages from the United Kingdom. So I'm glad that we're starting to be able to push this discussion on a global level and to invite people to participate. And a lot of people did. So I thought what we could do today is to look at some of those questions that came back. And said, and we're not going to be able to go through all of them today, but there were some big themes. So I took sort of the first in line of the big themes and said, right, let's take these forward. Some of them, for unknown reasons, they want to stay anonymous on air, which is fine, but we'll be able to talk about them. So I thought what would be a really good place to start is that, Shan, you had a very good interaction with a chap called Declan Hoffmeyer, who's from the Eastern Cape, runs a major facility out here, a 17,000 hectare reserve, and is experienced in the conservation field. And I thought his comments were quite interesting. So why don't we take a look at that one first?
Yeah, sure. So his comments were, Mr. Hume's project may not have a current viable business model, but in the unlikely event of a global opinion change on the use of rhino horn, it could become very viable, but that's not the point. And then he goes on to say, we must find some way to move away from tourism and donor finance as the main income generators, which that is going to take some big kahunas on someone with a massive risk appetite and resources who is willing to test the system. I'm currently writing this from a property in the Eastern Cape that is just shy of 17,000 hectares and has been on the market for the last 3 years. After investing some 200 million rand, here the owners have decided that the liability outweighs the potential benefits. There have been a surprising amount of interest from some well-known international business names, but they all have, save one, walked away saying the same thing. The business model just doesn't make sense. And the save one person left for other reasons. So he goes on to say, my question remains as pertinent as ever. Investing in gold makes for good business sense. Heck, I have small investment myself. But until we learn how to eat gold, is it actually logical? Yes, you can sell your gold to buy food, but how does hoarding these shiny things ensure that we have clean water, clean air, and even the opportunity to be, quote, out in nature with its associated healing properties? Impact bonds, biodiversity and carbon credits, NFTs and ESG investing are all portions of this question, of this question's answer, but are not clear cut yet.
Yeah, I mean, it covers a lot of ground in that, Shannon.
Sorry, there's one more part. I don't have the answer, but I absolutely have a reason to spend a lot of time thinking about what the answer could be, because one thing is clear, we need that answer.
Amen to that. Mm. If I can jump in, I think he touches on a couple of really important things. And what I appreciated about his comment was that he recognizes the viability challenge to Hume's business model. And it is unlikely that there is going to be a change in global trade regulations and trade law that will see the opening of trade on a level that would make it viable for the claimed conservation value. It's not going to happen anytime soon. And it's unlikely to happen in the period that we desperately need the solution. So this perpetual digging our heels in and fighting for A and B, we're starting to get more validation from people on the ground that are working with Rhino every single day that are coming and saying, we need plan C. Plan A and B are questionable. We need plan C. The other thing that I liked about his comment was that he's very confident. And I emphasize the word confident considering he's in tourism, but he very openly suggests that there is fragility within the current sort of eco-safari business model. Yeah. You know, we increasingly, land is expensive to obtain in Southern Africa. It's extremely difficult to protect. With poaching continued, it's very expensive to keep and maintain rhinos. So there's just these layers of expense where I think historically it was much easier to get into the game. And the barrier to entry was less. So your anticipated returns were a lot more forgiving, dare I say the word. So there was a fairly adequate balance between the passionate investor, which is why we've seen everybody from Richard Branson to a whole host of people, major international moneyed people buying properties. And it was a bit of like an ego purchase maybe, but they were all viable in their operation at some point. Ulusaba does well. The Singitas do well.
Yeah.
So that worked well. But to get more people into the game, to protect more habitat, I think it's quite challenging. And the thought that crossed my mind when you were reading that, Shan, is looking at the different land ownership models throughout Africa. So if we look at most of East Africa and in the southern parts of South Africa, definitely Botswana, it is very rare that you can buy the full title deed of a piece of wild land. I think at varying levels of maturity, a lot of African countries that have communities that have ancestral ownership of wildlife or reserved lands are trying to find a way that there is some kind of economic emancipation for those communities. So it's saying you can't buy the land, but you can lease the land. So that model works pretty well. It comes with its own challenges, don't get me wrong, but it works very well in somewhere like Botswana, which is going through quite an overhaul in terms of how those allocations are made and what constitutes a rate of return to the community. So more and more education, employment, equity, and not just the lease agreement can and must be part of that discussion so that there is a greater sense of skills transfer. Now, the good thing about that is that you don't have the burden of the purchase value of the land to be able to put your $5 million worth of lodge on top of it and to trade successfully within reasonable time. The rate of return in those investments is already quite slow because the number of beds are very, very small, which is why they charge $2,000, $3,000 a night, some of those places. But it makes it accessible somehow, and it forces very mature businesses to transfer skills and opportunity to local community members. What we don't have in South Africa is that. What we've got in South Africa is a far more Dutch Roman land ownership law model that says, I own the land, everything on it, above it, and under it is mine. Mm. So here, if you want to start a reserve, like Declan refers to, that 16,000-17,000 hectares, those initial investments were to purchase the land, build the property on it, to build the infrastructure, run all of the protection sequences that are required to look after it and the guests, and then from that base, try and trade out. Now, that property that he's talking about, I believe it started at 580 million was the asking price for that piece, for that property. And it has since then come down to where I think it's about 350 odd million now. So a radical drop in that. But those owners have got to try and recoup at least their investment cost for the land and the property. Whereas if you've got a 15-year lease in Botswana, for example, you're not recovering as much to generate value from that operation. So it's a very, very interesting comparison for me on just the two ownership styles and how different governments are seeing the opportunity. And I wonder if it's not worth finding some property specialists. You know, I think of people like Colin Bell would probably be able to talk to this very successfully because he's worked in all of those countries running safari and lodge operations. And I think that that's actually a really good idea. I think we should give him a call and say, what are the challenges? You know, the barrier to entry is just getting higher and higher.
But you've also got the pandemic kind of changed everything as well for everyone. And so I think more than ever, we need to, like he mentions, find ways to protect the land, protect the animals, protect the wild that's not dependent on tourism. We have to find other innovative models.
Well, I mean, that's totally agree with him.
That's very true. And I find it very interesting that, you know, the discussion starts with rhino. But what we're talking about really is a dilemma that faces all of wildlife conservation.
Correct.
Because at the moment, between what governments can afford or are prepared to allocate, charity and tourism, those are the revenue streams, and they are quite clearly showing themselves not to be enough. So, you know... Yeah.
The tourism industry, you know, if we look at South Africa's past and the desperate need for economic transformation across the country, tourism is one of the least transformed. I mean, I'm willing to bet if you had to look at the major players that were around in the mid-90s to the major players that are around now, largely the same. And I'm not saying that bad. I'm not saying that they are suppressing anything. Don't get me wrong. But what I am suggesting is that in a socio-political climate that has changed dramatically across the continent in the last 20-odd years, I don't believe tourism has kept up with that rate of societal change. So I think Declan raises a very, very valid point, is that that is increasingly fragile. And Shannon spoke to it perfectly. She said, you know, and COVID just showed how fragile that model is. So to look for those different methodologies is powerful. I've yet to see a conservation NFT work. Forgive me, maybe I'm just a dumb bush guy, but I don't understand how NFTs on a sustainable measure, on a campaign measure, yes, I get it, but on a sustainable measure can transfer value to conservation on a dependable basis. I think the concept of all of the carbon markets, ESG, impact investment, I think it lies in there. But I'm also curious, you know, if we look at South Africa's model, so there are various investments that get you a huge amount of tax benefit, for example. So if you are buying land and you apportion a percentage of that, which I believe is a very small percentage, to generating solar power, for example, there are tax breaks on the purchase of the entire land. Mm-hmm. And so are we potentially looking at ways of saying that these reserves quite often sit alongside burgeoning communities? I mean, you think about Kruger National Park, and in the last 20-odd years, you've gone from a couple of 100,000 people in the Bushbuck Ridge area to almost 3 million in the space of a generation. That's an extraordinary amount of growth. So if there was a way of saying that part of that western border of Kruger could be utilized for solar power, for example, that could go into Bushbuck Ridge, for example, are we looking at blended models where there is a societal value and not just an investor value? Because I would like to think that those friction points won't just start the fire of a fight, but could start the fire of a really, really strong relationship. And I know I'm utopian in that, but I'm struggling to find the way of just describing that. I think that Declan is right. If we start to look at the merger of industries and not just how do we fund this one and how do we generate profit from this one, I think there's a discussion to be had. Obviously, I'm not suggesting we go into extraction discussions like we've seen in northeastern Namibia with our friends from Recon Africa, who, as we talk today, are ripping that part of the country up and down and risking the Okavango Delta, or in Mozambique, or up in Tanzania. I'm not saying the extraction industries are there because that defeats the purpose, but I think that there is a move towards renewables, towards solar, towards different opportunities that this land could be valuable. But as he says, the answers aren't there. We need someone to be brave enough to put it forward. But governments can create the appetite for confidence. And how do we generate that discussion?
What would be very helpful, in my opinion, for immediate help for people is rather than us looking for that answer and looking for that industry to get into that will generate the income, there are so many successful businessmen and women out there running companies that are doing well. Every month, they are bringing in really good money. And if they, each person, each company would just pick a nonprofit, an area to protect, an animal sanctuary, just pick something you care about that you can give a small piece back to every single month. And then that becomes an ongoing revenue generator where these people can then project what they can do and not just live hand to mouth month by month, but it's an ongoing thing that really helps people more than they know. Even a small part of the masses they're making could make a huge difference for the planet.
I think what you're talking about there gives a really good buffer zone. We can't take our foot off any one of those accelerator pedals in terms of generating revenue for the NGOs or for tourism. We've got to do all we can to support those sectors as much as we can. And I think that your point talks to that. I'm trying so hard not to take the bait and go into a discussion that says, well, philanthropy is a function of profit, but impact should be a function of business. So I think that these organizations shouldn't leave it to the risk of declared profit, whether those on the front lines are funded or not. I think that is an incredibly risky model, because if South Africa's economic state gets any worse, fewer and fewer companies are going to be showing a profit. So a percentage of that profit being given to philanthropy is going to go down.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be, you know, money made in South Africa then goes to a charity in South Africa, because it can go wherever your passion is. But if every company out there stepped up and did their small part, it would buy us a lot of time while we figure out what the option three is, you know, option C.
Totally agree. Peter, you wanted to say something there.
Well, I think one of the things that we're failing to realize is that actually, like one takes on climate change or any other big issue in the world, there should be and I know there's any number of bodies that are supposed to be doing this, but it's obviously not working as well as they should or at all. But the thing is that looking after nature is a responsibility that's shared across this planet. And, you know, people are looking at it always from a small point of view. You know, in South Africa, this is our nature. This is our right to do what we want with it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we've got to start looking much more broadly and to say, like, we have to collectively, the countries of the world have got to reverse climate change, slow it down, halt it, reverse it. So the same we've got to do with nature. We've got to halt the exploitation. We've got to steady it and start working it back. Because otherwise we need those 30% of this and 50% of that. Never, ever.
I think on that measure as well, I have a slightly warped view over the United Nations. But the United Nations generates, I believe, it's something of the magnitude of $40+ billion a year. And its operational expenditure is a fraction of that. What I see the United Nations could be is the world's largest and most credible impact investor. And if there was a model that started to suggest that you would be able to receive funding and support from the United Nations, if you could show a business case for your solution to a problem, I wonder how many billions would be unlocked for risk-free investment into innovative solutions that we need. Imagine if the United Nations took a fraction, and I know there are a multitude of boards and divisions of United Nations that are looking at almost every topic we ever discuss on the podcast. But if there was a way to attract on an investment level, think of the United Nations as the world's greatest impact shark tank, and that there was investment afforded to those with the credibility to take a risk on and to back their innovative solutions, and not just conferences and not just regulations and not just things of that nature. I wonder what could happen. And I know I'm speaking crassly, and no doubt I'll be corrected quite fairly on many of the things that I've said, but the money is there, is my point. But we still see the protection of the planet as a function of profit, not how we make profit. So if we're going to make 100% of our profit by screwing up the planet and then expect to fix it with 3% of declared profit, we're freaking delusional.
Yeah.
So let's flip the model and let's look to these major organizations to help us flip it. God knows they've got the resources to.
Silicon Valley, tech.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on to another question, shall we? This one came from Kevin. And Kevin says, why is trade such a bad idea when you could flood the market? Simon, you mentioned that there is not enough rhino horn to do so, and that is just not true, he says. If 2 tons of rhino horn is poached every year, the industry can supply that. So, Kevin, you touch on a lot of things there, and I want to try and just separate them out because I can see you champing at the bit there, Peter, and I'm right behind you. So we're talking about why is trade such a bad idea? And the reason for that is that we can flood the market is the assumption. The second assumption is that we have enough rhino to continue to flood the market. And I assume Kevin means through legal trimmings, dehornings, et cetera, stockpiles, what have you, and trading them out. And then he says, and I'm not too sure where this number comes from. I'll try and get my head around it. The idea that says the number of rhino being poached at the moment yields, say, 2 tons into the illegal trade, but the legitimate trade could supply that. Now, I think the 2 tons of rhino horn is poached every year, I don't think is 100% correct. I think that the assumption is if there's, say, 500, which has been roughly the average for the last couple of years, 4 kilograms of horn, you're going to get to 2 tons. The horns are a lot heavier than that. So I would argue that they're probably poaching closer to 5 tons at present would be my, between 4 and 5 tons would be my assumption on that. What he doesn't take into account, which as you guys know, this is my soapbox and we're not talking about it enough and I'm not going to let it go until this becomes a public conversation. What about the stockpiles? It doesn't take a brain surgeon to look at any one of the seizures that have happened at OR Tambo in Doha with the work by Qatar Airways and amazing people that have caught these guys. If you look at those images, a horn that comes from the bush will take the entire horn. So the bottom of a rhino horn is concave. It goes over the nasal cavity. So the poacher will go in and leave not one hair of strand behind as they take that horn. So a wild horn, if you can call it that, has got a concave base. But a trimmed horn has got a perfectly flat bottom. Why in seizures are we seeing perfectly trimmed horns? Unless the stockpiles themselves are compromised. I know you're gonna take over from me in a second, Peter, but the idea that we can supply trade based on what we can trim from captive or from wild rhino, for that matter, each year, the argument is that that can be supplemented on a regulated measure from the stockpiles that have been built up over decades. I say, prove it. My assumption, and my fairly safe assumption, and I won't say why it's safe, but stockpiles are compromised. We are not sitting on the amount of horn that we think we are to supplement the trade. Anyway, we need to start talking about stockpiles and where are they at and how much is actually left before we carry on with these ridiculous regulated discussions. Peter, over to you, because I know you probably want to talk about Dr. Esmond Martin, I'm sure.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, you've touched on a lot of points there. I mean, we can kick off with those stockpiles. All audits are incomplete and they're inconsistently presented. So the estimate, I think it still stands, that the African stockpile, if you can call it that, not the individual countries, but what's held in Africa in stockpiles, is around 100 tons. And that is likely to rise in coming years because we... You know, given the number of privately owned rhino and the increasing practice of dehorning, so it makes sense that more and more should be being stockpiled. You know, it's estimated that South Africa alone could produce something between 6 and 15 tons of legal horn a year, so-called legal horn. I mean, the reader that sent in the question said about 2 tons into the legal trade. Yeah, it's probably based on we're assuming that the rate of poaching is today. But if we go back a couple of years, we would be estimating that something shy of 2,000 horns would be going into the market and nearly 6, 7, 8 tons of horn. So if you take what can be produced and you take from what we've stockpiled, then yes, one can say that it makes some kind of sense to say that we could supply legal trade. But that's at first glance. You know, you can't make a bland statement that will cover the demand. I mean, if we cast our minds back to the 70s, when wholesale poaching was carrying on to the north of us, where we were largely protected here in South Africa, you know, something during the 70s, some 8.8 tons of black rhino horn alone were entering the illegal market. So that changes the position altogether. So if you've got more and more going in, are you in fact developing a bigger and bigger demand, a bigger and bigger market? And if that is so, you've only got to look at the size of the populations of those consuming countries and to say if only a portion of those people are brought into the market because it is now reasonably available, what impact that is going to have. So we could find an exponential demand, and we really don't understand the economics. That's really what it boils down to.
I agree with you.
We do not understand the economics.
Well, I think that one of the mistakes Kevin's comment, I think, makes, if I'm understanding it correctly, is that it mistakes supply for demand. Because if you're saying that the poachers are taking 5 tons, whatever it might be, so they're pulling 5 tons of rhino horn out of Africa each year. And while we can cover more than that, that's not the size of the market. That's the size of the poaching industry. And to suggest that that is the size of the market is literally to say to every single anti-poaching unit, every single investment made, every single life lost in the protection of rhino, you really didn't need to, because that's all they want. With all of these investments, from Hume to Sandparks to Warren Buffett to the Walton family, an extraordinary amount of money has gone into the protection and the efficient use of that money, I might add, into the protection of rhino in particular. What would it look like? What would poaching look like if we didn't have those measures in place? If we didn't have organizations, that countless organizations that make it their business to protect rhino and to stem the trade? All we're doing when we're saying that this is the amount that was poached in the 60s and 70s, and this is the amount being poached now, and we can exceed that. We've just described the poaching efficiency. That is not a market dynamic. That is not the size of the market. That's simply what they're able to get out. And I don't believe for a second, just carrying on from your point, Peter, is that if we look at China as the predominant market, 60s and 70s, hugely communist state at that time, with a population almost half of what it is now, under strict rule, very little disposable income through the masses. And now, in this quasi-capitalist communist country that it is now, with an extraordinary level of wealth and global wealth, I can't see any logic, let alone empirical data, that suggests that the market is the same size or less. The population is twice the size. The economic participation of its population has gone through the roof. The number of people buying product in China is through the roof. Now add the dynamic that the trade has shifted since then to include Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Japan, US to a lesser extent. But all of a sudden, the market is that much bigger in terms of the number of countries that are participating in it. To suggest a historical figure saying that was the size of the market, and not to apply basic sensibilities to say that the market hasn't grown since then, I think is just delusional.
Well, it is, and there's also this assumption that the legal market would supplant the illegal market. So if you have a legal market, the illegal market will go away.
Yeah, this is the point I was going to make. Exactly. Yeah.
That will carry on. Yes, it might lessen to an extent, but it's not going to go away. There's always going to be the market. So you're never going to be left alone with a piece of property that you don't have to protect as much as we're protecting now. Because if you ease up on that, they're going to say, thank you very much. It's become even cheaper for us to get wild rhino horn. So, you know,
It is. And I mean, the other thing that I struggle to get my head around is, and I've heard so many traders say this in various forms, if we're allowed to trade, we will drive the price down, flood the market and drive the price down. So assuming you can flood the market, you tank the value of rhino horn as a result of that. And there's lots of economic principles and value bases that suggest that might be true. And I've even heard one protagonist say, you know, it would be our job to kill that market. But are you going to bankrupt your business? Why would you have driving rhino horn down, the price of rhino horn down, to a point where it is not necessarily viable anymore because your cost of goods is bloody expensive while the poacher's cost of goods is zero. But at the same time, you're saying that the revenue generated from the sale of rhino horn will go back into conservation. So what you're saying is that the more successful we are, the less money is actually going to go into conservation. Doesn't make sense to me. I know that there are 1,000 economic professors that would be able to explain that to me, but I'm openly asking, explain that to me, because in the idea of drive the price down to create revenue for conservation while we kill the trade, how are you going to create revenue for conservation if your intention is to destroy the value of your product?
Yeah.
I struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is quite expensive to take off rhino horn, especially if you're going after them in the wild and you have to have a helicopter and all of that. It's an expensive process. And no matter how much we cut those prices down, it's still cheaper to go for a poacher to go and kill them for free. And no matter what price we think we can drive it down to, they can always undercut us. Always. Exactly. So yeah. It just doesn't make any sense. And besides, both of you use the word in the legal market, but there is no legal market, not internationally.
Yeah, it's so, a total hypothetical.
I know, I'm just saying. Let's not forget, there is no legal market.
Okay, let's jump onto another one. How much does it cost to protect rhino with an APU? With an anti-poaching unit.
You know that one firsthand.
My gosh. I'm up to my eyeballs in APU budgets. It's a very well-timed question, Mr. Anonymous.
Yeah.
How do you qualify that? First thing, I think that what I've been going through myself over the last little while is that there are a couple of schools of strategy over investing into an anti-poaching unit. I think there are some organizations that believe, let's put as many boots on the ground as we can. So we'll take rangers, we cross-skill them, we put guns in their hands, we put them on fence patrols, we send them out, and that's an anti-poaching unit. And they have extraordinary success with that in certain areas. And then there's a swing to the total other side, which is a side that I favor. For our particular situation, I don't think it's a right solution for all. Again, got to stress the sensitivities of your choice and strategy are going to be dictated by location, poaching threats, topography, size of land, size of team, size of budget, etc. So there's lots of influences on that. But the approach that we've wanted to take with our land is to find a balance. I am increasingly questioning this radical militarization of conservation because it requires a problem. And we just need to look at America as a fantastic example that America's economy is reliant on having an enemy. That entire military complex must be deployed and using supplies for the US economy to hold up. So it must pick a fight. It must find a reason to be deployed. It must find a reason to be on alert. And I worry that, again, huge influences on that, but I worry that in certain sectors, we're taking a trajectory that says this industry of anti-poaching that has been born out of the poaching crisis needs poaching to exist. In other words, for people to be employed, rhinos must be killed for the good guys. Mm-hmm. We need a problem for that to stay in existence. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not saying we shouldn't be investing in these people and the tech and the guns and all of that stuff. God knows we're doing it. But I am deeply passionate about what is the crossover, specifically in the deployment of tech, in what works very well to work on the protection of wildlife. How can we turn that into an equal ecological and conservation asset. So in other words, if you sending drones up to do fence patrols, are they able to take meteorological data? Are they able to contribute to census counts? Can that drone drop down and take a water sample from a waterhole where you've seen three dead buffalo close by? Is there any operational efficiency that can come from the shared deployment of the investments made into the militarized approach? I believe yes. And as we're saying this, the most beautiful little bushbuck has just walked up to my door and is looking inside. Absolutely.
Oh, that's so cool. I wish you could show us.
Absolutely.
I have a beautiful little Maltese that just crawled into my lap.
Well, he's a Maltese vulture the way he eats. Sorry, I got distracted there, but it's the joys of doing a podcast in the bush. So what we've decided to do is that we're putting a major investment into technology to say, what can we do to create the most the most unobtrusive investments into the land? The other problem that we have is that the more people you have, the more potential for corruption. So we've decided to go with a very highly skilled, incredibly well-equipped, incredibly well-resourced tactical team that is able to respond throughout our entire precinct in a matter of minutes. And between the patrols, between tech, between all of these things, we can put a tech bubble over the entire property. And we've got eyes over every animal in that property. And we can monitor movements inside of that, thermal imaging, all kinds of wonderful things. So I think it really depends. But to give you an idea, you can equip an anti-poaching soldier for anywhere between 50 and 150,000 rand, which is a huge amount of money on the top end. Some guys go to 200,000 rand and they've got night vision goggles and all kinds of sexy
toys. And you put that in dollars for people, approximately.
Right. So 50,000 rand, what is that? That's about $3,000 at the moment. And about all the way up to $8,000 or $9,000.
Yeah.
So quite a big span of, and that's the onboarding cost. And then you're probably looking at a top APU ranger will be earning between 10 and 12,000 rand a month. So bring that down. You're talking about a salaried, experienced ranger will be earning $600-$700 a month. So it's not, if you look at it in that, in US terms, it's not a lot of money.
But
when you look at in rand terms on the ground, the human cost is considerable. Then there's also the other considerations like housing them, feeding them, vehicles. If you've got a fully equipped Land Cruiser, you're looking at least R1 million. So that's about $70,000 per vehicle. If you've got a canine unit, you've got the cost and training and the maintaining of the dog or dogs, their food, their handlers training, fuel costs, insurance costs, tech costs, consumable costs, and all of these things run on. So it's very easy to see that like a lot of the reserves will have a security cost that sometimes is as high as 30-35% of your annual expenses just on anti-poaching security. And that's a combination of tech, vehicles, assets, operational costs, and onboarding costs.
Yeah, it's a lot. It adds up.
It's a hell of a lot. It adds up quickly.
Yeah.
And the ongoing training is absolutely critical. Absolutely critical. You know, as I'm learning, it's fascinating the number of anti-poaching units that carry around big guns, but they barely ever fire them. Imagine a soldier that never went to the range. So once you've got all of these things, you've got to use them. Yeah. Even if not in anger, you've got to get those skills up and maintain those skills levels. So it's an extraordinary expense, Mr. or Mrs. Anonymous.
And then it's their health insurance, their family insurance, in case something happens to them. There's still so many other little things that when you start digging into it, you don't really think about it first, but they're all really important to them.
Absolutely. And I think that the other one to consider in all of that is mental health. I don't think we see nearly enough investment into the mental health of the men and women on the front lines of conservation. They're seeing, you know, these animals that they protect, they know them. Many of them have known them since they were calves, since they were cubs, since they were babies.
Yeah.
So they're family members. So the trauma of seeing, imagine walking out into your back garden one day and you see your dog shot and its face cut off. That's what it's like for these rangers, for many of them, and their families. These guys get up in the morning and they say goodbye to their wives and their husbands and their kids, knowing that they might not come home today. And all they signed up for was to look after wildlife, not to be shot at. Yeah. So it's an extraordinary ask, mental and emotional ask, of the rangers and the rangers' family for them to make the sacrifices they do, all for a couple of hundred dollars a month.
And what I think of when you say that, I've also heard stories of rangers that get deployed into a big, vast, wild area for a couple of weeks. So they might be out there on their own for 2 weeks straight. They don't have like the proper nutrients and vitamins in their body to support their emotional capacity. I mean, I think about myself and how unbalanced I feel, and I work really hard at my health. Imagine having to be out there and cope with everything that's thrown at you and not having the right nutrients in your body or the right shoes on your feet and socks and not having all those things to support you. Yeah. I can't even imagine that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm learning it firsthand at the moment as I go through all of those preparations myself. And you think about it. I think about the two of you. I think about Peanut. I think about Mom, my brother, my sisters, my friends. Yeah. Every single time I put that bulletproof vest on.
Yeah.
It's real. You feel it. I'm feeling it in ways that I've never felt before. So for the first time, I don't just have sympathy, I have empathy. Like, I really know what it feels like now, and it's not fun. And I mean, cannot glorify anti-poaching.
No. But just being in a space as well where you need that bulletproof vest. I mean, I have a bulletproof vest now for when I'm out there. I mean, I'm not on the front lines, but when I'm out there, there are times I'm scared. Yeah. You know, and the fact that I need a bulletproof vest, I mean, that is scary.
Yeah, it's real. It's absolutely real. There's no romance to it at all. Anyway, well, guys, we had so many more questions that we couldn't get through. So I think we're going to have to carry these over to next episode and talk more about this because they're not too time sensitive. But we're out of time today already. And it just never really feels like enough. But to everybody that's listening, thank you so much for your comments. Thank you so much for your questions. It really, really helps us focus the content of what we talk about on the subjects that mean the most to you. So please send through your requests, your questions, your comments, your preferred topics, whatever it might be. Send it through at info@theartofconservation.com. Please follow us on social media channels all and about. And wherever you are getting your podcast, please leave a rating and a review. It certainly does help us massively. Thank you to Peter and to Shannon. I will be home soon. I love you both. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Good show.
Thanks, everyone.
We must rethink our relationship with wildlife, the environment, and each other. Join us as we uncover the innovative, unifying, and urgent solutions we need to protect the planet from ourselves. This is The Art of Conservation.